It is a state capitol report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In recent days, the Republican-controlled legislature denies Governor Tony Evers' special session, with child care funding one piece of that agenda, seeking to continue a pandemic-era subsidy program for providers to help cover the costs of running a daycare. We examine a package of Republican proposals aimed at child care businesses and families and hear from you. Call in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ruth Schmidt is executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association, a nonprofit supporting the early childhood workforce and early care. Ruth, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
So Assembly Republicans introduce a package of child care bills. One proposal would allow a family to create a pre-tax savings account worth up to $10,000 each year for child care expenses. What do you make of that idea?
So I believe, in part, it is just encouraging that both houses are deeply into the child care conversation and keeping doors open, along with obviously the governor being incredibly supportive of child care needs in Wisconsin. And the package of bills that were introduced in the assembly, while we oppose some of what was in that package, there are a handful of bills, including the one you just mentioned, that I think would create an important support for working families and options for others to make contributions on their behalf to that type of a savings account. So I think it creates avenues to support families' abilities to cover the cost of care. So I think in that way, it's good. But the entire package of bills falls dramatically short of what is going to be needed to keep our state from falling into a really dramatic childcare crisis without ongoing significant public investment, similar to what we had in Child Care Counts, which expires in January of 2024.
And we're going to get to Child Care Counts in just a bit. But so what I'm hearing from you is that when you look at this legislative package as a whole, there are pieces and parts of it that you think could have really promising aspects to it. But by and large, we have to do something pretty major here in Wisconsin. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
I think that's exactly what I'm indicating. And I believe that you can fix childcare several different ways. One is to charge parents more, which parents right now are tapped out and just can't afford anymore. The other is to put a public investment in place, which is what I am hopeful Wisconsin will still sort of rally around that in a bipartisan way. I believe there's a little bit of a light at the end of that possible public funding tunnel that we'd wait to see what happens. And then I think there's this concept of, can we sort of loosen up regulatory standards in childcare? And to me, in states that have looked at increasing ratios of more children in a classroom with one adult, or lowering the age of teaching staff, we're not seeing significant changes in affordability and availability of care. And mm-hmm. So from my perspective, this is not an industry that is looking for loosening of regulatory issues and standards. And so within that assembly package of bills, there were a couple what we would consider really onerous bills that would, from our vantage point, would really deteriorate the quality of care, the safety of care happening in our state. And I don't think we can take what is best for children out of this conversation as we look at fixing what's needed.
Ruth Schmidt with us leads the nonprofit Wisconsin Early Childhood Association as we discuss new proposals to address child care costs in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions, your comments about this legislative package, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ruth, the package would allow younger teenage workers to fill certain childcare jobs and allow centers to supervise more children per worker, as you alluded to. How would these changes, though, affect childcare services?
So one of the proposals is looking at lowering the age of assistant teachers to 16, which would be a teenager, someone who should still be attending school. And additionally, what is problematic about that bill is it would allow them to be in a classroom unsupervised. So the bill would require there to be adults on the premises, but does not require that direct supervision when that care is being provided. And I just think developmentally for where 16-year-olds are and what the demands of caring for babies and toddlers and, you know, the needs of keeping those children really safe in a classroom is something we should not be putting on onto, you know, the young shoulders of 16-year-olds. It's just not safe. It's not best practices. And it's something that my organization registered in opposition to.
Would lowering the minimum age of childcare workers, could that be an issue with accreditation? Is there accreditation hanging in the balance here?
So for accreditation standards like the National Association for the Education of Young Children or City of Madison accreditation, there are requirements in terms of both ages and ratios and education criteria of the adults that are working in those programs. And this would put some of that into jeopardy.
Let's bring in Angie in Eau Claire. Angie, hi. What would you like to share?
Just a comment. My husband and I both have bachelor's degrees. I'm a nurse, he's an engineer. We have no student loans. Our three kids, well, now our oldest in kindergarten and has wraparound care, but our kids for daycare, despite our wonderful jobs, even in this economy, we pay half of our income almost to daycare. And the daycare is highly rated and it is wonderful, but the teachers are still making $12 an hour and asking for donations of literally anything willing to offer. So it's hard when we love the daycare teachers and they do a fantastic job, but they're not getting taken care of or compensated nearly enough.
Angie, thank you for sharing your story. Ruth, three kids, half of income going to daycare and wraparound care, and it's just not enough for those teachers in early childhood. What is the disconnect here?
The disconnect is that the business model of childcare is not a functional model of running a business. And yet it is absolutely what is necessary to staff appropriately and keep kids safe and meet their developmental needs. Janet Yellen had called childcare a failed market. The dilemma is childcare programs, after they cover their general operating costs, their building and maintenance expenses and utilities and materials and food and upkeep of playground equipment and insurance, they have very little left for paying teachers. And there is nobody making money in childcare. If there were money to be made in childcare, we wouldn't be having this conversation, right? Mm-hmm. And so what has happened is we've got parents that are pitted against childcare programs. And in many cases, I think parents, as Angie indicated, like they know there's really good care happening and they know it's really expensive and they know teachers aren't getting paid very well. And the answer, again, is not to expect parents to pay even more. The answer is to understand that the reason parents need care is so that they can work, which is an economic good for our state. And we need to start understanding that we have to finance childcare in such a way that it provides this as a public good for our economy, for businesses, for livability of communities, for healthy families and children. And that's the dilemma. There's just not enough money left at the end of a month to compensate people in this workforce with what they need to earn.
Ruth Schmidt leads the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association responding to legislative proposals focused on child care. And you can be part of this discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share your perspectives. 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Democrats and Republicans diverge on how to make child care work for Wisconsin. We examine recent proposals as the Republican-controlled legislature quickly adjourns and takes no action in a special session sought by Governor Tony Evers that includes funding to help support child care providers. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts anytime at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Ruth Schmidt, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. Ruth, we saw on Wednesday Republicans formally rejected child care proposals by Governor Evers, the governor asking the legislature to pass a package of bills, including dedicated child care funding. Do you support the governor's proposals?
We believe that Wisconsin needs a significant public financing mechanism to help maintain and grow care in our state, child care in our state. Child care counts has been an amazing opportunity for us to see what happens in child care when it is receiving public financing. This was in the form of COVID relief funding that has supported it. And when it's gone, it represents a loss of about anywhere from $11 to $22 million a month going into childcare in our state. And somebody's going to have to pick that up. So my association is fully supportive of what the governor has proposed, a significant $300-plus million state GPR investment into childcare. And we're pleased to see that there is this tiny little window where the session was not gaveled in and gaveled out. It was sort of, it was adjourned for the day. The bills that had been put out there by the governor have been put into the, introduced in the Senate. We're waiting to see what will happen. I am not holding out dramatic optimism that the governor's entire package with this huge fiscal note attached to it is something that will get funded. But I do believe that both sides of the aisle and both houses of our legislature are understanding that we have to do something. Doing nothing is going to create dramatic losses in childcare. We surveyed programs after the state budget was finalized. We're seeing close to 87% of childcare programs saying they're going to be raising their rates, some as high as 30 or 40%. We're seeing that a third of childcare programs are considering closing if there's no state financing for this. So I think it's important that this is still sort of, the window is slightly open, a crack, and we're waiting to see what happens in the Senate.
Well, Governor Evers asking the legislature, as you say, more than $360 million to continue Child Care Counts, the program. And Evers says the state's child care industry is facing this looming fiscal cliff if the funding for Child Care Counts is discontinued.
That could result in the loss of over 4,880 childcare jobs. That'd mean leaving more than 87,000 Wisconsin kids without childcare, potentially causing about $500 million or more in economic impacts between parents leaving the workforce and reduced employer productivity.
So it really sounds like they've crunched the numbers here. Would the money sought by Evers be adequate to address our state's childcare staffing issues?
So what we're seeing in childcare staffing is that probably two-thirds of childcare programs are trying to hire people And when you can't hire people, it means you close classrooms in your program, which means you're reducing capacity of care available in a community. And the governor's plan would go a long way to supporting programs' ability to keep those classrooms opened and continue to pay bonuses and wage supplements to their employees. Will all of this fix what is going on in childcare? Our nation has a childcare issue, and I think DC is grappling with it. I know every state in the country is grappling with what is going to happen when the stabilization funds are gone. I think it is a strong step in the right direction to stabilizing what's happening in care, and is something that's just really needed in our state.
Ruth Schmidt with us leads the nonprofit Wisconsin Early Childhood Association as we learn about new proposals to address child care costs in Wisconsin and proposals in the works here. You can join in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Ruth, State Representative Joy Gobin of Hobart is sponsoring a majority of the recent child care proposals. And in an interview with WKOW this month, Representative Gobin said child care counts proponents aren't giving Republican child care legislation proper consideration.
These bills were not given merit on their own, for giving consideration for their merit. It was simply, no, we want child care counts. We do not want to do anything to improve childcare now. And we need to work on improving childcare now, making slots available for our families who need care.
Are some childcare advocates prematurely dismissing the new Republican childcare legislation?
And my answer to that is a resounding no. These bills aren't just being dismissed out of hand. These are ideas that have been floated for many, many, many years in our country, and there is very little enthusiasm for these types of bills from within the childcare sector. Putting more kids in a classroom with one teacher as a way to solve this issue is loud and clear stating that we aren't looking directly at what is best for our children. You can't just undercut childcare and expect there to be high quality available care in communities. And saying that it is reasonable to expect a 16-year-old to handle six babies unsupervised in a classroom, to me, is, it's unfortunate that it was even proposed. These are bills that are not going to promote the safety of children and developmentally appropriate care.
Republican State Senator Howard Markline says renewing Child Care Counts program would make Wisconsin obligated to spend hundreds of millions of dollars from what was supposed to be one-time pandemic funding. What is your response to that?
These issues existed long, long, long before the pandemic. We've been trying to look at how do you solve this for a very long time. We proposed significant investments in the past. And so I don't think that it is just a one and done with what's needed. We needed it prior to COVID. We still need it. And I believe in a state where we're sitting on a dramatic surplus of revenue, and it's not just a one-time surplus. This is ongoing budgeted surplus, and we have to make decisions on how to spend it. And to me, $350 million out of a $4 to $5 billion surplus is like saying we're going to take 7% of it and put it towards little kids. And I just think that's a really important commitment for us to make as a state.
Well, in our last 30 seconds together, you mentioned that there's a placeholder, if you will, on these child care proposals, special session remaining open. So both sides of the aisle, there's more in the mix. Where do you think the conversation will go next among lawmakers?
I think we're waiting to see what happens in the Senate. I think that's, this has already moved through the Assembly. We know where the governor stands. We're still waiting to see what leadership in the Senate you know, where their appetite is going to be to actually, you know, cut a deal. And our fingers are crossed and we're hopeful that there's bipartisan support to do something in the Senate, and we'll sit and wait and see what comes out of the Capitol.
Ruth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Ruth Schmidt is executive director of the Wisconsin Early Childhood Association. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Two dozen of our nation's leading authorities on law, elections, and information security, they issue 24 recommendations for safeguarding the integrity of next year's elections. And one of the authors who worked on this project called 24 for 24 is Julia Azari, political science professor at Marquette University. You can join in as we discuss steps for election fairness and legitimacy, especially as it affects Wisconsin. Call in with a question, share your thoughts anytime at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Julia, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
You joined this group of law professors, political scientists, computer scientists, and others to issue these recommendations on improving elections. Why did you join this initiative?
Well, I joined primarily because I was invited. And it's a really important group of scholars and practitioners and, like you said, lawyers, law professors, who are trying to come together to do something I think is really fundamental for our democracy, which is to both ensure that elections are run well and administered well, according to best practices and according to evidence-based practices, but also to improve the perception of elections and to really kind of hammer home the kind of broad value that elections in our country are really, they're fundamental to the practice of democracy, and that they're the practice of elections, the rules that go into shaping them, are not for political football. That this is something that everyone of all political persuasions should be invested in, and invested in kind of finding common ground and finding shared beliefs and shared practices.
Okay, and so peeling back the curtain a little bit on how the committee worked together here, you get divided up into different aspects of this project and then come out with four distinct areas of recommendations in law, in media, politics and norms, and technology. And so you become part of this norms, rule of norms in politics. What were the interactions like in your committee? How did it work?
Right. So this is closed session. And so I'm not really at liberty to, you know, tell you any dramatic stories. It wasn't too dramatic. If you've been to an academic gathering, you probably can imagine. But yeah, so the way this worked, first of all, I'll say this was a 2-day gathering at UCLA's law school. And the first day was public. It is online. Anyone can watch that if you want. You Google 24 for 24 UCLA law. You can watch all the panels. There were some very interesting public presentations. One of the early sessions featured an election administrator from Arizona who played some of the voicemails that he received after the 2020 election. So the public portion was quite quite interesting. And then on the second day, we convened privately and talked about essentially how can we come up with guidelines and ideas. And the politics and norms, we were thinking a lot about, you know, about partisanship and about how to make sure that the norms of democracy transcend partisanship. And that's not an easy ask at this point. And certainly here in Wisconsin, election administration has become really kind of deeply partisan in some ways. So that was kind of what we were trying to do. We're trying to come up with also ideas and principles that would kind of fit across the nation. We're trying to issue some guidelines and some best practices for the whole nation, knowing full well that elections are administered at the state level and even maybe more importantly at the local level. So you're really talking about hundreds, if not thousands, of jurisdictions at that point.
Yeah, I wonder, is that hard to do, to provide some sweeping guidance when states do elections in myriad different ways?
Yeah, I think, you know, so we didn't focus as much on that in our group because we were really focused on kind of these big ideas. One of our ideas, for example, was to suggest a kind of blue ribbon commission of people who have some kind of trust across the aisle, not just politicians or former politicians, but entertainers, athletes, you know, people who are in the public eye and have the public's trust to kind of promote the basic guidelines of democracies. That's kind of where we were at. When we had other sessions and at meals and I spoke with people who work in election administration across the country, that's always fascinating because there are these different kinds of details about how elections are administered. So I imagine in some of those that was quite challenging. But if you look at the recommendations in that section of the report, they're quite general. And again, they're really focused on kind of what are the big picture principles of what a democracy needs to run, rather than on kind of the details of the day to day.
We're talking about the new recommendations to improve elections. Marquette University political scientist Julia Azari with us on the 24 by 24 committee. You can join in with your questions and comments. 800-642-1234. Julia, you say acceptance is key to improving future elections. Losers of fair elections should quickly accept election results. What was your subcommittee getting at there?
So I think the thing to kind of think about here is the way that we use the kind of recount process or the processes that we have in place to challenge election results. And there's kind of two ideas there. And one is that you really use those only in a situation in which there's some evidence to suggest that that's the right course of action. Many states, including ours, have some rules around the closeness of an election and a recount. The thing that really kept jumping out at me as I was sort of looking back at the recommendations is the role of time in elections and the role of timing specifically, that there's a time where there's a campaign and everything is kind of in flux and you want the rules to be firmly in place at that point, the rules of the game, before you know who's going to benefit from them. And then once the votes have been counted, you're in a different kind of moment in the election process. Once election day is over, that is not a time for people in the political process to go back and try to use the rules to have another bite at the apple. And I think that's really the value and the principle that we're trying to get at there, is there may be situations in which a recount is appropriate or in which it's appropriate to have some other legal challenge, but that we ought to take standards of evidence really seriously and take that time dimension really seriously. When the election is over, the time to have partisan contestation is over.
But isn't that somewhat out of the hands of election officials as to how candidates conduct themselves in the aftermath after losing an election?
I mean, yes, that recommendation was sort of more generally directed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Let's take a call now. Jeff joining us from Delafield. Jeff, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I think a lot of the mistrust of the process is a result of the growth of absentee voting. And for example, when that polling place becomes everybody's kitchen table, how do we know what conversation is taking place when that ballot is being filled out? Somebody, I presume, presents the ballot, maybe mails the ballot, and that person sits at their kitchen table and fills out the ballot. How do we know what conversation is taking place there? And the reason it's concerning, I think, is there are laws that there's no politicking allowed within a certain distance of a polling place. Well, what happens when that polling place is everybody's kitchen table?
Jeff, I want to just allow Julia to jump in here. Did the committee address absentee voting?
Yeah, so the committee definitely addressed various elements of securing the election process. I want to be clear that this is both, you know, kind of a matter of some controversy. And one of the things this group did really well, I think, was to bring people together across different political perspectives. There were, you know, all different kinds of political ideologies there, and also people who work primarily on this sort of voter access side. And people who work primarily on the election security side. And this was taken really seriously. The ways that we thought about this that were, I think, were sort of came to the fore actually had to do more with electronic balloting, which one of the members of the committee has really deep expertise in, and kind of making sure that that's secure, but also making sure that, you know, the rules are clear, the balloting is secure. There aren't kind of loosey-goosey elements to the submission of absentee ballots. I think what the caller is getting at in terms of, you know, what might be going on with the politicking and the absentee balloting, that just can't be, I don't think that can be regulated. You can't tell people what political conversations to have. And so I know there's concern about absentee balloting and the way that's conducted. We were not as primarily focused on that as we were on security. And part of that reflects, I think, the breadth of the kind of political and pragmatic perspectives of the group.
In your group says Congress and states should dedicate funding to pay for rising election costs in the future. How should the federal government and states approach establishing this funding?
So I think the main thing with the report was concerned with, and again, I think you see in some of these recommendations, I apologize, my email is still on. I think in some of these recommendations, you really see that what we're really looking for here was kind of the broadest common denominator across different members of the group. So different people are going to have really different views about where that funding should come from, state and local, and how, you know, what should be done with it. But what people were concerned with, if you read the report, is that funding is public, that mm-hmm. funding is coming from, ideally, really from a centralized source where it can be distributed evenly. One of the complaints in the kind of voting access community is that to the extent that election administration, so like the machines, the poll workers, the facilities, not campaign finance funding, the extent that those are funded locally at the county level, that's going to produce a lot of the kinds of inequities that we see, you know, across localities. So the extent it can be centralized, it's going to be more equal. But the other big concern is that a lot of the funding that came up in 2020 that kind of provided a stopgap measure to make up for all the needs of that election process was private. Some of it coming from Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chen. And so that was, you know, that was, I think, a real concern among people who study election administration at a detailed level, is that there isn't any evidence that there was anything wrong with that per se, but that produces a perception that, you know, that there might be a partisan slant. So the more it can be public and evenly distributed across party, across income level, that's really the kind of core value that the group was trying to get at.
Julia Azari is a professor of political science at Marquette University, one of 24 members on a nationwide ad hoc committee for 2024 election fairness and legitimacy, led by a UCLA law professor. As we discuss these recommendations, you can be part of the conversation, calling in with a question, sharing what's on your mind, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A national nonpartisan panel led by UCLA School of Law's Safeguarding Democracy Project issues 24 recommendations for safeguarding elections, and we examine how such guidance would work here in Wisconsin. Marquette University political scientist Julia Azari served on the ad hoc committee for 2024 election fairness and legitimacy. Join the discussion along the way, calling in with a question, add your views, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Julia, the committee issues several legal recommendations, and one says states should strengthen laws to protect election officials from violence, threats of violence, and intimidation. What changes are needed in Wisconsin to address this recommendation?
Oh, man, Wisconsin. I think I was thinking about this a lot over the weekend, and I think that in some ways, Wisconsin has sort of progressed a little bit past where the kind of main thinking in this report was. I think, to be honest, a lot of the value in this report, a lot of the ideas that went into this report, were thinking about how can you make a situation in which election administration doesn't become a kind of main talking point between the two parties and become completely partisan. And we have sort of passed that. But I think one of the things that, you know, every state could stand to do is to both have laws on the books and also have a kind of publicization of norms coming from respected political authorities that we don't harass or threaten election officials in the course of doing their job. That's really one of the things that the report, and again, here the report is very general about all different localities, is to strengthen these laws, to come up with practices where it's difficult to find out the names and the addresses of these election officials. And it's sort of, to me, a little bit astounding that it's come to that we've gotten to the point where we would take the kind of, you know, trade-off between having transparency about knowing who people are versus really having to protect their privacy. But that's where we're at. The other thing I've also thought a lot about was this sort of, I'm not totally sure how we would do this legally, but right now, you know, we've got this debate about impeaching our top election official. And the report talks about protecting election officials from kind of legal trouble in the course of doing their job. That they do something illegal, fine, but also they sort of should be protected from legal trouble if they weren't really doing anything wrong. And I don't know that changing our impeachment laws is necessarily the recommendation I would make, but I was thinking a lot about that and thinking about the fact that if you have consequences that people face that are so severe, for doing their job, no one is going to want to do these jobs.
I wonder, too, when you see election officials and politicians disagreeing publicly about the management of elections, that conflict, it by way, it then erodes trust in elections. Can you speak to that?
It does. And I think that that's, you know, I think there are a couple of things here. I think that one of the things that was really guiding the report was thinking about how people who are in the public eye, elected officials and other actors, can really bolster trust in elections while simultaneously thinking about real changes that make elections more secure, more trustworthy themselves. Mm-hmm. I wish we knew more about kind of what affects trust in elections. There actually have been some studies that suggest that it's really partisan, and that people across the political spectrum are susceptible to these kinds of narratives when their side loses. And so that's really where responsible public officialdom comes in. And again, there's a little bit of a trade-off between having a public debate about, you know, what is the proper role of an absentee ballot and what are some limitations on certain forms of balloting. Those are legitimate topics for debate, versus using this, you know, purely to undermine an election result that you don't like, particularly after the fact.
We have Marquette University political scientist Julia Azari on the 24 by 24 committee looking at new recommendations to improve elections. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff in Appleton is with us. Hi, Jeff.
Hi there. There's a lot of things you can do about the physical election and voters and stuff. My question would be, how do you handle the information getting to the voters, specifically the Hunter Biden laptop, which was suppressed by all legacy media and by social media companies as well? How do you address that information that's not allowed to get out and then make it a fair election?
Jeff, thank you. And short on time a bit here, Julia, the role of media and social media. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we did not talk about any specific issues or the way that media treats specific issues. Everybody across the political spectrum has their views about what issues are maybe not being covered enough. We mostly talked about the role of media in promoting a kind of understanding of how elections physically work. And the most important one, in my opinion, was actually about counting the ballots. What you do, again, once those ballots are in and they're being counted, and sometimes that can be a slow process. And so the main thing we had kind of suggested there is that media not report that as if it's a horse race. You know, one candidate is in the lead and the other candidate is behind, but that it is still too close to call or not enough ballots are in. So we were really focused on process and not on specific issues, be it Hunter Biden's laptop or anything else.
So why does framing the language important there, you know, saying that something is too early to call versus one candidate being in the lead? We have about a minute.
Yeah, so I think the idea there is just not to feed any more kind of partisan horse race things, and also to understand that the way the way ballots are counted will sometimes have one party that will look like one party is in the lead, and that will be an artifact of the counting, mm-hmm. as opposed to something that's real. What it really is in reality, those ballots are in, right? Is that it's too close to call, or too early to call.
And then just finally here, election officials adopting a .gov email address. This was important to the committee.
Yeah, I think this is also just to sort of to demonstrate a kind of legitimacy and officialness to the process. And so, again, it goes back to that idea that the elections should be proper and secure, and that they should also be portrayed that way. And that perception is really important in this process as well.
Julia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Julia Azari is a Marquette University political science professor, one of 24 members on the ad hoc committee for 2024 election fairness and legitimacy. We have a link to the report. It's at WPR.org/mornings. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.